This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream. You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Ever since Bree Ripley was young, she knew she didn't want to reproduce. Despite her struggles with other birth control methods, doctors still refused to allow her access to a tubal ligation procedure. Tie My Tubes is a forthcoming radio documentary, co-produced by Jocelyn McDonald and Bree, that follows Bree's story, but also looks at the broader issue of sterilization, both voluntary and forced, and looks at why it's so difficult for women to access tubal ligation as a permanent birth control method. I spoke with Jocelyn and Bree over the phone last week. Here's that interview. Bree, why don't you first tell me a little bit about your history and your past experiences with birth control?
Wow. So I started on birth control at 16. It was the pill. And that was around the time I became sexually active. In fact, the first experience I ever had with birth control was right after I had sex for the first time, and I went and got Plan B. And it was because I was hyper anxious about becoming pregnant since I started from the beginning of having sex. And this anxiety existed. It started off, it kicked off with Plan B, and then it became the pill. And then when I was around 17, the pill just was not working for me. I noticed that it was impacting my moods, and I was already on a whole bunch of psychiatric medication because I was wrestling with like a lot of depression and anxiety as a teenager. And I decided like the pill was not working for me. It was making me really irritable. So I started to go on Depo, and as soon as I did Depo for about a year, I gained 15 pounds, and it was the kind of weight that you just cannot lose because it messes with like your metabolic system and it changes like your whole everything. And so that was kind of devastating as a teenager already coping with, you know, self-esteem issues, you know, wrestling with your self-image on the daily. So then it became a whole slew of different things that I decided to try. So I'm from like NuvaRing to the patch to finally I was like, I need something that's going to be, you know, not obstructing like my daily life, like not ritual based. So I decided to go with the Mirena IUD because a doctor talked me into a LARC, and at the time there was like a deal on it with my insurance where I paid $300 for it. So I got that at 18, and I was in a monogamous relationship with a man at the time. And it was like one of the most painful experiences that I've ever had getting it inserted. And that pain lasted for weeks and weeks because it was just, I was hemorrhaging blood. And I thought that this was going to be, you know, my solution, but it turned out to just be another hindrance on my body, on my daily life, on an emotional and physical level. And it continued that way because after about a couple months, I started to get monthly yeast infections on the Mirena. My body totally rejected it. It was the worst. It was impacting my intimacy with my partner. And not only that, but like my intimacy with him was impacted because he told me he could feel it.
Weird.
And yeah, really weird. Scariest experience with Mirena was I still kept trying. I had it in for about a year. And at a certain point, my monogamous partner and I broke up, and I was having sex with several different partners, and we were using condoms. And at one time, this was like the scariest part when I decided to just totally get it out. Cause I mean, yeast infection, sure. But I was like, I don't want to get pregnant. This is the solution right now. We were having sex and he took the condom off and was like, there's a hole in this condom. And I can't be certain whether or not it was from like the fishing string from the IUD, but I'm super suspicious of that. Mm-hmm. And that was terrifying. So I immediately just went in and I got it taken out. Removal was also terrifying and horrible. And After that, I tried Nexplanon, the implant, and got on a couple more forms of birth control that I just hated. Nexplanon broke me out. I had cystic acne in places I never had acne before, and the birth control was just causing like migraines with aura and just like a slew of things I did not want, and I did not want to have to experience or, you know, be subject to all of these different emotional, physical setbacks just to protect myself against pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So I haven't been on birth control since October, and since then my birth control methods have included the pull-out method, condoms, and Plan B twice.
And so you decided pretty early on in your life that you wanted to get sterilized, as I understand it. I wonder if you can talk about why.
Ever since I was a kid, I knew that I saw parental figures who were not biologically parents. And they were very deliberate when it came to parenthood. And I had a direct experience with that because the parent I'm closest to is my stepfather. And he married my mom when he was around 40 and really became our dad. My biological dad was mostly out of the picture growing up. And so, and my mom became more and more, she unraveled in her mental illness. And so I saw, you know, my mom as somebody who was not ready for motherhood, and just based on lore and stories throughout the family, sort of used motherhood as a tool for her relationship, like a manipulative method of making my biological father stay. And as soon as I sort of like found this out, and I found this out very young, I was like, this is even more reinforcing the fact that, you know, I found out that was an unplanned pregnancy. I found out that my mom made, you know, a whim choice to keep me, and then had my sister again to sort of as pawns, like we were pawns in her game with men. And that was terrifying to sort of wrap my head around as a teenager. And I also just like, I knew for a really long time that there were alternatives to just having your own biological children. The idea of being pregnant to me, even when I was young, seemed like such like a, it was like capturing women and putting them within this box that confined them to a certain, like, this is the spectrum of womanhood for you. This is what was expected. And I always rejected that. I always rejected norms for women. It was just terrifying to me that, you know, when I went to the checkout line at grocery stores and I saw bridal magazines, or, you know, seeing like maternity clothes stores and like all of these things that are just really hyped when it comes to selling things to women based on like what the stereotypical experience of their own life should be, could be, according to our culture. And I hated that. I admired like strong independent characters in books. I was a huge fan of witches growing up. I watched a lot of witchy TV and movies, read a lot of fantasy books, and none of those women had children. And I've always wanted to like imagine myself in like different careers. Never imagined myself with children. And I know that since I was little, it like having that core belief coupled with like my experiences with birth control really solidified, like at 17, even when I was having, you know, poor experiences with just the pill and like Depo, and feeling like this perpetual anxiety about becoming pregnant because birth control is not 100% effective, no matter what method. So I was just done with that. I was so done. Mm-hmm.
And so you made that decision, and what happened then?
I started asking about sterilization when I was as young as 17, and that's really what happened next.
And who did you approach? Did you approach your doctor about that?
I approached all of the doctors that I saw for checkups when it came to birth control. Like, I was going in regularly to go get new birth control and to talk about it, because obviously like I exhausted a list, like I told you, like this laundry list of birth control that I've tried, and that took a lot of different appointments with physicians. And each time, pretty much after Depo Provera and gaining the weight and realizing the impact, the physical, emotional, and mental impact that birth control was having on my body, I was like, well, I don't want to have children. And it was, you know, general family care physicians and OBGYNs.
Did you ask them if you could get tubal ligation?
I didn't know the words for it. At the time, I was asking for permanent birth control. Mm. I knew the term sterilization. I told them that I never wanted to have a child and I wanted to be sterile. And I started asking for tubal ligation specifically right after Marina, when I became more serious about figuring out what a permanent option would be for me.
And what was their response?
In the beginning, at the very beginning of it, it's so dismissive. Like, we didn't talk about it for more than 2 minutes, even when I would press. And they would tell me, like, I'm just going to, like, echo. It's like an echo chamber at this point, how many times I've heard it from other women. But, like, you know, you're too young to realize, you know, to know that you don't want to have children. You know, one doctor, a male OBGYN that I saw, first and last male that I ever saw for my vaginal health, was like, your biological clock is going to do a lot of things to your body and brain. And at that point, that's when you can make a decision whether or not you want to be a mother. And it was always like, you know, the response was like, oh, you don't know whether or not you want to be a mother at this age. But it's like, it was almost just like, because they were saying that, they weren't recognizing, they were dismissive of the fact that there were so many different forms of motherhood. And none of them like talked to me about that. None of them wanted to like talk to me about, you know, the alternatives. And so like, I guess the top phrases were, you're going to change your mind. You won't know until your biological clock starts ticking. Nobody will tie your tubes unless you've had a child first. I don't know a physician that would tie somebody's tubes this young. And what if your partner wants children? That might contribute to your decision later on.
Hmm. And you've met lots of other women who've had similar experiences?
They've said almost the exact same things that I've heard. It's like an echo chamber. It's insane.
Is there a specific age that they tend to make women wait until before they're permitted to make this decision for themselves? Have you found there's like an age limit?
Honestly, it varies. Like it varies from physician to physician, from OBGYN to OBGYN. And it depends on there's like a lot of different factors. But I think what it comes down to is what the moral standards are for that particular physician, like what that physician believes is the atypical average age. And I think it's like between 25 and 32.
So one of the things that we've heard consistently, we've interviewed women in the US, in Canada, and in the United Kingdom, and all of these women have similar stories of going in. If women are going in younger than 25, then the doctors will say, come back when you're 25. And then they will come back and they'll be told, come back when you're 28. Mm-hmm. Okay. Come back when you're 30. Okay. Come back when you've had one kid. Oh, you've had a kid. Come back when you've had two kids.
Yeah.
And, we've also heard women say that their doctors will basically, it's like, the secret is that they'll deny you the first time and then you're supposed to go in and ask for the same thing every 6 months until you get a referral to a surgeon. And so not everybody has had success with that, but it's something that we hear again and again, that the doctor wants to put you through some kind of test to make sure that you've made up your mind rather than trusting women to know what they want.
Mm-hmm. So, and Jocelyn, so you're in the midst of producing this radio documentary about Bree's experiences and about sterilization and reproductive freedom more generally, as I understand it. How did you get involved in this project and how did you find Bree?
Well, Bree is a long time friend of mine and we met
in a crosswalk.
We met because we kind of overheard each other talking about radio and immediately decided we should make radio together. So we made our first podcast together, what, 2 years ago, and it was about catcalling and how public space is made unsafe for women. Mm-hmm. And so this project came about, basically Bree has been in radio for a long time and been telling other people's stories, and it was, you know, January that she decided to start telling her own. And so, of course, I was super excited to be able to help make that dream come true.
And in the course of working on this documentary, what have you learned about the history of sterilization in the U.S. specifically, but also globally?
Well, sterilization was originally developed as a feature of the eugenics movement, as a key part of the eugenics movement. So encouraging undesirable women to stop having their undesirable children. And this included non-white women, poor women, and feeble-minded women. So this continued, this kind of eugenics attitude, what did that start maybe in the 20s, and has still been, I think the real secret here is that it's been going on up until the present day, and we don't talk about it as eugenics anymore, but women are coercively sterilized and pressured to be sterilized, if not outright forced to be sterilized. So one of the most famous trends in forced sterilization that's recently come into the news is that in California prisons, women were sterilized for decades, and they were, some of them were sterilized without their knowledge. And so in 2010, Governor Jerry Brown outlawed sterilization in California prisons. There's also been a lot of cases coming out of women who were sterilized as a part of a plea deal. So criminality is one of the things that influences when women will be coerced or forced into sterilization. The justice system in the U.S. is still using sterilization as a part of plea deals. There's a third-party non-governmental organization, I think based out of North Carolina. It's called Project Prevention, and it has gone by other names. It used to be called CRAC. And that acronym was appropriate because the women who they targeted for sterilization were poor women who had a history of drug use. So one of the factors that goes into coercive sterilization is not only poverty, the color of your skin, and your history of alleged or convicted criminality, but also if you've already had children. And so one of the things that we see again and again is that people who've had more than whatever the society or I guess justice system has deemed an appropriate amount of children. One of the recent news articles that I actually found on Feminist Current was the story of a couple of Saskatoon Canadian First Nations women who both of them had more than a few kids. And so the pressure was basically like, you're having too many kids. Think of what you're doing to society, to the taxpayers. You should not be allowed to have more than three kids. This is like the sort of arbitrary number of children we've decided should be in a nuclear family. You need to stop.
And in terms of voluntary sterilization, what's been the case? You know, what's the history around that?
I think voluntary sterilization was not really within the realm of like conversation. Like it was never within anybody's like syntax, vernacular. Like nobody was talking about that because it's never been focused on pregnancy prevention until birth control came out in the 50s and was marketed in the 60s. And so we had like this new language for talking about delaying pregnancy or, you know, controlling when a pregnancy would occur, which empowered women and gave them options. Options are empowering, of course.
Voluntary sterilization has definitely not been a part of the larger conversation about reproductive justice and reproductive access, except for women who've already had children. And so women who, one of the most common ways to get a tubal ligation is directly after birth, whether it's a vaginal birth or a C-section. C-section is great because it can happen at the same time. But as far as voluntary sterilization goes in like the national trends, it has historically mostly been for women who already have children. And I think it's becoming more accessible to women since the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, because it counts as birth control, and it has a degree of protection, and so it has to be included in insurance plans. And that's the other thing. So, you know, it is an elective surgery, and so historically women in the United States have not necessarily had insurance that would cover it. The other really key problem with this in the present situation in the U.S. is that sterilization is not available at religious hospitals, especially Catholic hospitals.
Or Planned Parenthood. It's not available at Planned Parenthood.
Right. So that's the largest network where women access birth control. Right. Washington State, where we live, has the highest number of Catholic-affiliated hospitals in the country. And so if you think about this, women who want sterilization may have to travel, you know, 70 plus miles to get sterilized. It's an unrealistic burden to ask women to travel that much, but it's also in some cases not possible, because if you have all of these, if the majority of hospitals are Catholic affiliated, they have a conscious objection to any kind of birth control. So Catholic hospitals don't have to provide your birth control. That means that you might not have a hospital in network at all that would be able to provide you sterilization.
Hmm. And you mentioned that Planned Parenthood even doesn't provide sterilization. I mean, like, I wonder, do you find that this conversation is marginalized, not just in the general public or the religious right or whatever, but within the feminist conversation around reproductive justice and reproductive freedom?
I think the finger's on the pulse of, right now, abortion rights. I think right now we're in a critical position to be talking about abortion. And I think the other side of the conversation, the one that's sort of left out, is women, you know, obviously you do not want to carry a pregnancy to term if you want an abortion and pursue an abortion and have one. But then on the other side of the fence are women who do not want to carry children to term ever at all, period. And I think right now, just culturally, it's not examined. And so no one's talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? I mean, especially, as I said, you know, like with progressive people and people who are fighting for abortion rights and people who are fighting for reproductive freedom, like you would think that this would be something that feminists would be pushing for.
Because we haven't developed the language yet. Like, mm-hmm. We are culturally conditioned and groomed to have this understanding of womanhood, and it's a patriarchal product to not have the language to start talking about these things or to identify them, because women who have had these feelings, like, have known that they do not want to be a biological mother or want to be child-free, feel like they're alone. Like, they don't know how to talk about this. I've talked to a lot of women who didn't even know what the word child-free was, and they were like, thank you for giving me language and letting me understand that I am not alone, that these feelings aren't isolating. And when women do have conversations about this, when it comes to, like, you know, bringing it up with family and friends, they're shamed. Mm-hmm. And so this shame, this culture of shame for, you know, rejecting motherhood or deviating from the norm is very similar to the culture of shame that surrounds abortion. And so only recently is the conversation becoming louder and louder when it comes to women talking about their bodies and terminating pregnancies. And I think that a lot of the conversation, when it comes to, like, feminists and people on the progressive side, will start turning up as soon as we start talking, like, giving names to things that have not been talked about yet because they have been it's just not part of culture to talk about these things. Yeah, it's taboo. Mm-hmm. It's asinine that it's taboo, but it is taboo to reject, denounce motherhood.
It's taboo even among liberals. And I think one of the biggest problems that we face here in the United States is that because abortion is so restricted and becoming more restricted all the time, the primary focus of the reproductive justice movement is still on protecting access to choice. And the conversation in the 70s was, you know, abortion on demand without apology. NARAL stood for the national abolition or repeal of all abortion law. And what our movement wanted was unrestricted access to abortion, where the decision is solely between the woman and her doctor. And the conversation has become so twisted because, you know, we've basically seen so many losses that we've just said, okay, well, we'll water down this conversation. We'll water down our demands. And so we can, you know, have some political expediency and some pragmatism, but that's resulted in the reframing of the entire conversation as, please let us make this choice. Please let us be human. It's a small request for us to have this bodily autonomy.
Well, also, like, I feel like you can identify why this is excluded right now within the conversation, tubal ligation, sterilization. I mean, like we said, like, Planned Parenthood doesn't even offer this as a birth control method. It has been left out of the dialogue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having a tubal ligation surgically is as dangerous as giving birth. I mean, the parallel is, it's, like, baffling.
I wonder, have you approached Planned Parenthood or anyone involved to kind of like ask them why this isn't something that they offer or are really talking about?
Yeah, I spoke with a couple women who worked with Planned Parenthood, and it's because Planned Parenthood is already under so much pressure to have to fulfill all of these requirements just to have an operating clinic. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the funding for surgical procedures that require like anesthesia, and that would require a whole other, you know, just like a huge process of being able to afford these things and also have the standards that, like, the hoops that they have to jump through already. Mm-hmm. And that would be an entirely another level of having, it's just so trying just to give women access to birth control as it is. But having it be left out of our options makes it seem like it's impossible and doesn't inform women that this is part of their birth control options.
Yeah, yeah. And I think people don't see it as a rational decision that a woman can make. They still see it as something that's driven purely by biology. And so I think that it's sort of not seen as something that women can control or even choose, which is weird considering the conversation around choice and birth control.
Well, I mean, is there any decision that women are assumed to be rational enough to make? Mm. I mean, it's true. And I mean, we're already seen stereotypically as the more emotionally irresponsible or emotionally amplified gender. And it really works into the narrative of women as the sex class that that women should be breeders and that women's highest aspirations will eventually be to become a mother. But I think one of the biggest ironies here is that the public conversation is that, you know, you shouldn't have children that are unplanned. We should be having fewer babies.
But the sad thing about that is the default is sex and the default is pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Those are the defaults that exist within, like, the culture of, you know, sexual intimacy.
So the right wants to discourage women from having kids outside of heterosexual marriage to the tune of 2.5 babies, but, like, is also unwilling to talk about what it means to prevent those pregnancies.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, what would you like to see change in terms of the medical system and women's contraceptive choices? What would have to change?
It's almost just like this is the beginning in my mind of, like, another round of consciousness raising. Like, we are talking about it. What I hope for is to provide a network for women, a beginning point, an entry point for women to start, you know, maybe give an opportunity to start identifying themselves through, like, this language and these conversations that we're creating and making connections. Like, in the beginning of this, Jocelyn and I were talking about, like, oh, we really want this documentary to get in front of the eyes and ears of medical professionals, medical providers. And then all of a sudden it changed, like, within weeks when we realized that this documentary is not for healthcare professionals. This documentary is for other women.
So expanding the identity of people who want to be child-free, giving them the resources. There's, you know, we found a lot of resources on the child-free subreddit, and there are doctors who are willing to perform tubal ligations on people who are only 22 years old and maybe even younger. So basically, you know, we want women to know that there are doctors out there that will do this. There are people who will trust you to know what you want out of your life. The other thing that we need is for physicians to trust women. And so, of course, when young women come in and they say that they want a sterilization, we all understand it is a permanent solution and it therefore carries a great deal of gravity. Nobody's going into a sterilization thinking like this is some kind of light or trivial decision. So if we can expand the idea of informed consent, if we can get physicians to say their piece, you know, this is a permanent surgery, you know, you have to be sure that you want it, but then to trust women when they say, yeah, I've thought about it, I want this.
And there's like, it's also the women's healthcare is so fetus centered. It's fetus centric. It's about the baby. It's about making sure women are healthy so that they can carry a pregnancy to term and have a healthy baby. And I would like to see like the ideal future is it's about women's health, not about a potential child of a woman's health. It's not about that. And the other thing is like to start having a conversation with healthcare professionals that regret is not the worst thing in the world.
Regret is not a big deal.
We are allowed to feel our emotions.
We're allowed to make mistakes.
It is okay to regret things.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the idea that if you were sterilized and, you know, 10 or 15 years down the road, you did decide you wanted to have children, that there's no other options is a bit of a weird one, too, because there are still options.
Yeah. That's exactly it. Also, no one's ever, like, really, like, privilege is a huge part. Like, we're addressing a lot of our privileges when it comes to even be able to talk about voluntary sterilization. Like, as a white, educated, able-minded, able-bodied woman, I have to, like, I am going into this as, like, I am in a major position of privilege to even be opting for voluntary sterilization. And, like, this is so important for me to recognize, and I think about it, like, every day. But the other part of that is, like, I still have a womb. Like, I still have a uterus. And there, as science advances and as it continues to advance, you know, IVF treatments for women, which I would never consider, but is always, like, it's so left out of the conversation. And I think it's because, like, you have to, IVF is so expensive. It is also another privileged position to be in to afford that as an option for conception. But I think that that is one of, in my mind, you know, it's primarily been, you know, shopped around for women who cannot conceive on their own, who are having infertility issues or conception issues. But really, like, that to me is, like, the most planned form of pregnancy, like, very deliberate pregnancy. And I imagine a future where women can have the choice of that and where it's affordable, like, and if they want to do that, like, that could be something that they could have access to. But, you know, having a baby is also incredibly expensive. College is incredibly expensive.
Well, and it's interesting to think about this in terms of affordability and cost, right? Because something like sterilization, voluntary sterilization, of course, would obviously be a lot cheaper, you know?
And having a baby, yeah.
Well, then having a baby, but also all the other methods of contraception, cost a lot of money, and that's ongoing.
Yeah,
absolutely. And not to mention that there is a great deal of cost to the woman's biology when you introduce synthetic hormones. And I don't know a single woman who's tried birth control who hasn't had difficulties. So women end up trying 6 different birth controls until they find one that works for them. And some women never find a birth control that works for them. And Bree is a great example. She tried many birth controls and none of them were an adequate solution. And the body goes through a fair amount of trauma, you know, introducing all of these different birth control methods. For women who know what they want, it is ridiculous to be denied a simple surgery that is so cost effective, so inexpensive, so simple to complete, and has such a short healing time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and the other thing, I mean, I've had similar experiences to, like you said, most other women, where I tried a bunch of different birth control methods and none of them worked for me. They were all hard on my body, or they made me feel crazy. They just didn't work for me for a variety of reasons. And yeah, it's hard on your body, but also, again, people kind of don't believe you, right? They just are like, oh, have you tried this? Have you tried this? Have you tried this? And I gave up, right? Like, I just use condoms and the pull-out method also because there was just nothing that was working for me and I was sick of it. I was sick of doing all these weird things to my body that were making me feel crazy or unhappy or whatever. And yeah, I mean, even liberals and some feminists, I feel liberal feminists, I'd say, who are pretty invested in the abortion rights movement and things like that, kind of are not supportive of that choice or that experience, or they don't believe you. And they're like, well, it's fine for me. It's like, okay, well, that's good, but it wasn't for me. And it hasn't been for most women that I know.
Right. And where is this coming from? You know, we think, like, physicians encourage women to try different birth control methods, including long-acting reversible birth control methods. And so, you know, women are trying these things and, as you're saying, are not being believed when they don't work. And it's interesting to think about the lack of scientific evidence that these birth control options have long-lasting deleterious effects. But in the 70s, when hormonal birth control first came out, there were so many women who experienced severe health issues. And, you know, eventually birth control was only regulated by the U.S. Congress after these women's health was, you know, very severely compromised. And so at what point are we going to take women seriously when they're saying that these birth control methods, whether they're hormonal or long-acting reversible birth control, have really harmful effects? When are we going to get to the bottom of this and be honest, you know, get more research, get more peer-reviewed studies that support the common sense knowledge that women are sharing, you know, that this shit is really fucking their health up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it's so inequitable that men are men are given permission and rewarded for making permanent decisions, and women are not trusted to.
Mm-hmm. So finally, when will the documentary air, and how can people tune in?
Production wraps in June, and we are trying to enter a documentary contest by July 15th. So we are telling people that it'll be out this summer, and hopefully we will successfully meet our goal of July 15th. And we're on track to do that right now, as of right now, but we never know. I mean, it's really important for us to include the other side of the conversation to this. As journalists, it's important to incorporate opposing viewpoints. And it's also really important to recognize our privilege and to document and to share the stories and voices of people who were affected by eugenics and forced coercive sterilization, which we have largely been really struggling with finding these women who have been forcibly, coercively sterilized.
So on that note, we hope that anyone who's listening to this podcast as it airs on Feminist Current would reach out to us if they have any connections or any personal history with coercive sterilization. It's such a private issue and it's such a source of deep grief for women that it's hard for us to find women who want to speak about this. And we're desperate to tell that story.
I think it's an important story to be told. It's so important. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think the plan is to have listening parties to take this with us places, go up and down the West Coast, Canada, Olympia, Seattle, down to Portland, and just take it with us and have opportunities for people to come and listen, and eventually we will figure out what we will do with it next. So we're not going to immediately post it online, but there will be access to it, hopefully, in the form of planned events. And, you know, we're considering some other things, like opting into PRX, Public Radio Exchange, shopping it around for public radio stations. Really, we want to give it the best opportunity to be heard by as many people as possible. And so that's our goal, which is why we're taking our time and being very deliberate when it comes to where we will host it and how we will give it to listeners.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I'm so glad that you two are working on this project, and I'm so glad that I had the opportunity to talk with you about it today.
Thanks so much, Megan.
Thanks, Megan. This has been really great. I really appreciate it.
You just heard an interview with Bree Ripley and Jocelyn McDonald, co-producers of Tie My Tubes, a radio documentary. For more on their project, visit tiemytubes.com or find their page, Tie My Tubes, a radio documentary, on Facebook. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.